Welcome to the dsmith.org podcast for July 14, 2006. An early history of signal measurements and EMC, an interview with Michael King. I'm Doug Smith. So I have Michael King on the line here. Michael is really one of the pioneers in the EMC field. He's been in it, I believe, this August will be 46 years. And I first met him in 1987 at an ESD symposium. And we've been kept some technical contact since then. So Michael, tell me, what is the early years in EMC when you first got into it? What first got you in?
Well, actually, it was a friend of mine. I was still in school at the time, and I needed a job. The year was 1960. We had been in a recession in 59 and 60, so jobs were scarce, but this young man was wired into a company that was largely supported by government, and he asked me to come down and basically took a tour and got a job spot on the same day. And I was in what was called a systems engineering group that we didn't have EMC as a term, you know, or anything nearly approaching that term in that time. It was all about systems integration.
So back then, Michael, What kind of technical parameters were the equipment you were working on? What kind of speeds were they, and what were typical problems that you worked on?
Well, we worked primarily on what we would now call EMC to be EMC, meaning it was about compatibility of systems. The next question is compatibility of systems with what? Well, first of all, with themselves. We were having issues with rather high power radar, for example, particularly in Navy vessels, overwhelming sensitive receivers. Digital electronics was not widespread at the time, and a lot of it was still in vacuum tubes, actually. In 1959 and 60, the largest IBM mainframe computers were all vacuum tubes. So bandwidths were puny by comparison to what we have today. They were, generally speaking, below 10 megahertz for most operating systems. And to a very large extent, they were analog. So something like microsecond rise times were fairly fast, actually, in that time. And it didn't take too long before that moved up to 100 nanoseconds and then 10 nanoseconds. All of that happened in the 1960s. But at that time, it was rather primitive. So we were working on systems that were not compatible with themselves. Then the next question is, are they compatible with the environment? Well, what's the environment? Since military and government basically dominated the field at that time, the battlefield environment was the largest environment. And that includes transmitters across a warfare arena interfering with receivers and spectrum management and things like that. Spectrum management was still fairly much in its infancy in those years. And then on top of that, we had to worry about the environment in terms of nature, and that means lightning and higher power events. Bandwidth that we would have today that ESD would upset, for example, weren't too prevalent, so we didn't worry too much about ESD, and a lot of the signal levels were so high it was difficult to damage things through ESD. On top of all that, our measurement techniques compared to what we have today, extraordinarily primitive by comparison.
I wonder what the HBM threshold of a 12AU7 is.
I don't remember.
What about the interference measurements, Michael?
Well, interference measurements were extremely primitive at the time, and the company that controlled it, the instrumentation, that is, was the Dick Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company. And you can still find Stoddard, S-T-O-D-D-A-R-D, or sorry, T. You can find Stoddard equipment on Google. And the NM30A, NM for noise meter, 30A, covered the frequency range of 30 to 300 megahertz, and it is pretty much the standard of SISPAR today, even though it was developed in the 1950s. And they had various receivers that would cover from the audio frequency range of 30 hertz all the way up to about a gigahertz, and not as an integrated system, but in various boxes for various band sets. And all measurements were point-to-point measurements. That is to say, they were receivers with what they call a peak slide-back detector function. And what that basically meant was that you sat on a frequency with a pair of earphones and an oscilloscope monitoring the IF output, and the you had a knob, and at every frequency, if you wanted to know the peak level of something that you were receiving, you would turn the knob until it would no longer display as noise on an oscilloscope or in your headphones, as the case may be. And then when you couldn't hear it anymore or see it anymore, you'd manually bring the knob back and until you could barely see it or hear it, and then it's called slide back. So it was called a manual peak slide back detector function. And that's the way all measurements were made, except for average measurements that meters can detect pretty well. It was an extremely tedious process because it was one frequency at a time, then manually in this peak slide back mode. And what that peak slide back really did was it set a bias into the comparative bias, and the meter really wound up measuring the DC bias that would meet the IF output modulated level, and then they'd read that. That was the old days.
Sounds a little bit like titration to the noise level.
Yeah, that's very true.
Michael, how about specifications in that era?
Well, there was no Department of Defense at the time. There was the Department of the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army, and they all had their own fiefdoms that controlled their own systems engineering groups. And in order to be effective, it was necessary to know the individuals that were running these things in the various services. There was something called the Tri-Service Commission. The Tri-Service Commission for the three major branches of the military had a dotted line advisory service capability to kind of coordinate things. But there was no DOD, and there was no central mil standard of anything. We would work to mil I-16, 9-10, revision A, amendment C for the Navy Department, for example. Amendment C was for submarines that covered hull currents, induction currents, and the magnetic hulls of submarines, for example. Those exact specifications, by the way, are carried forward into MIL standard 461 today. If you wanted to go back in that kind of an antiquity and make a comparison, the measurement technique actually started that long ago.
Roughly what year are we talking about?
In the late 1950s, the early 1960s.
Okay.
A specification by a group called STL, Space Technology Labs, changed a lot of things, and that happened in 1962, by my memory. They wrote a specification that turned out to be called GM-07-59-2617A, which was at that point an Air Force Ballistic Systems Division specification. And it, for the first time, covered the frequency range of 30 hertz for various things, all the way up to about 10 gigahertz. And that was really the first integrated specification that, in some, looks a lot like MIL Standard 461 today, although it was primarily for the Air Force. The Navy Department and the Army had to throw their things into it. When they formed MIL Standard 461 in the late 60s, I sort of thought of it like taking all of the Bibles of all the religions of the world and slapping one hardcover around it and calling it the Bible of the universe. But in truth, it wasn't very well coordinated in those years, and it's been refined a lot in the process today. The term electromagnetic compatibility, instead of things like radio frequency interference, which is what we used to use, that term actually showed up because it dawned on somebody that measuring things in the audio, sub-audio, and the low frequency ranges wasn't really radio frequency anymore. So that's where the term showed up. And it really didn't show up until around 1968, if my memory is correct.
Now let's fast forward to today and contrast that kind of work to the kind of work that EMC engineers typically do today.
Well, today it's mainly about compliance to something and rarely about self-interference, from what I can tell. I've been saying for a while as an old-timer, that regulatory agencies have basically hijacked the term EMC, and because electromagnetic compatibility really isn't electromagnetic compatibility anymore. It's electromagnetic compliance, and compliance means to some specification of some regulatory agency. Rather than worrying about mass volume things today of trying to get a DVD player or some consumer gigaw into some compliance specification someplace around the world, where 30 cents in production becomes the universe of success or pass criteria. At the old days, we were all worried about getting it done, and money was much less of an object compared to other things like function and weight and delivery schedules. The 1960s were very, very powerful in trying to advance space technologies, advance military technologies, advance communication technologies, and it was all about getting the job done without much regard to cost in those years. Now it's all about money, and money determined in terms of pennies instead of technology.
Doesn't sound as much fun these days.
Oh, it's not. Not at all. It's not the engineering science it used to be, I don't think. It's about meeting regulatory agencies, often with criteria that are difficult to defend. Particularly some of the European susceptibility specifications are difficult to defend. And trying to get a product to market is distinguished from really trying to refine the technology within the product.
So, Michael, thank you very much for giving me this interview and sharing some of the early history of EMC.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. I enjoy doing it. It's fun for those of us who've been in this thing as long as I have to reflect on the old days and the contrast to what we have today. And I wish all new engineers that are now working in the field very, very well. And if you need training, give me a call.
Okay. And I know we covered ESD a little bit back in the Andy Hish Memorial, but maybe we'll do another one of these podcasts on the more technical aspects of ESD and where we've come from and where we're heading.
Certainly. It'd be fun to do that.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Michael has a number of his published papers and other information on his website that you may be interested in. And the web address is www.systemsemc.com, S-Y-S-T-E-M-S-E-M-C.com, systemsemc.com. And some of them are very interesting, and you might enjoy reading them. Again, thanks for listening, and send any suggestions for topics or thoughts on this podcast series to doug@dsmith.org.